Hi everyone, welcome to the Crypto Rabbit Hole. I'd like to officially welcome you to season two. So today we have with us Dave Newman, who is currently the president of KC3 Capital and was formerly the head of macro training at More Capital. Dave, first of all, thanks so much for coming. So just first off, would you mind running us through your journey on both the sell and buy side leading up to when you formed KC3?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think I graduated from college, Brown University in 1986. I went to work in a credit training program for manufacturers Hanover. I left there about a year and a half later I wanted to work in sales and trading, so I went to work for a bank to do currency sales and trading. I really didn't know what I was getting into. I just knew I didn't want to be in credit anymore, which is, probably a little bit short-sighted, but I was 23 at the time. And from there I went to Bank of Montreal. That included New York and Chicago, and then I went to business school at night at the University of Chicago, got my MBA. And then after that, I went to work at JP Morgan. I was there for about 10 years, half in New York, half in London. The merger happened between Chase and JP Morgan. It was a good opportunity for me to get back to New York with another firm, Credit Suisse, where I had a similar role that I had at JP Morgan, which was global head of sales and structuring for currencies, commodities, and some emerging markets. And then I left there in 2006. I went to work at SAC, where I was hiring portfolio managers in the macro space. And then I went to More Capital about a year and a half after that. I got recruited away. I knew of More Capital from, years of being in the markets and had a lot of respect for them. And it was a more essential role than what I was doing at SAC. So, I kind of took that on, and it was an unbelievable learning experience. And I left there in 2011. And, pretty much was kind of in semi-retirement. I did a little bit of this, a little bit of that in 2000, I think it was 16 or 17. I decided to just kind of pull my assets and kind of manage money on my own, which is, how I started KC3.
Awesome. Was you kind of touched on this a little bit, but was there a certain spark that in the beginning that kind of led you to be interested in finance?
I mean, probably I just thought, perhaps my, I was an athlete, so I played baseball in college, and I always liked being in the locker room setting and, being with my teammates. And, finance kind of just seemed, fast paced and, pretty team oriented, together. And, I knew some people that had kind of gotten into it that seemed like a logical next step. I didn't see myself as an accountant. I didn't see myself, kind of going to work for a corporation. I did want to make money. I kind of grew up pretty middle class, lower middle class, and that was kind of first and foremost. And, I kind of grew up outside of New York City and Queens. So, it's kind of, I guess, a little bit of that Bud Fox, from Wall Street, idea of, kind of making it big on Wall Street, that kind of somewhat resonated with me. But, there was a lot of people I knew that had gone into it that were similar to me. And, it certainly wasn't anything I had ever really thought about. I mean, I was really just thinking about, kind of getting through college and, playing baseball.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I can appreciate all that for sure. Did you kind of have any mentor or mentors, plural, at various stages that either helped you or you might even attribute some of your success to?
Yeah, sure. I mean, a friend of mine from high school, he ended up, I played baseball with, he ended up going to Cornell, and he kind of helped me get the job at Manufacturers Hanover, which, at the time, was a pretty good training program. Credit training is a very good thing to go through. You know, if you go to an undergraduate, which is kind of more liberal artsy, even if you're taking economics, you're probably not getting, you know, as kind of deep in the weeds as you need to be able to kind of, you know, do like a credit analysis job or, you know, markets type job. So, you know, that was good. And he helped me with that. And I kind of stayed in touch with him. So that was kind of initially. And then I think after that, you know, I had a manager when I was in Chicago that went to University of Chicago. That was a really bright guy. And, you know, I think he kind of helped me kind of find a space in finance that was, you know, a better match for my skill set and my interests. So I was doing options trading when I was working at Bank of Montreal. While I was going to business school, that was just, it was a little too challenging just to kind of do both. So he kind of got me involved in structuring, which is where you're basically trying to solve client problems, you know, and kind of offer them different risk management solutions. So, you know, I think that was, you know, very useful. I'm still in touch with him a little bit. I mean, it's been a long time. And then when I got to JP Morgan, I had a series of very good mentors. And I think one of the things, and you know, it's kind of instructive because I'm sure a lot of your listeners will go on to do amazing things, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, too much emphasis is put on A, where you went to college and brand name, and then which firm did you go to right away? And, the funny thing is that every single experience you have, whether it's a big, you know, big name university or, you know, well-respected academic university, by whose standards, I'm not sure. But, you know, between that and kind of like the bigger firms, you know, you can kind of run into this idea that you're smarter than you really are, and that you're more commercial than you really are. And, you know, the reality is that when I was working at the Bank of Montreal, you know, to actually compete doing what I was doing, and I was competing against, you know, much better firms. And, you know, but, you know, I had to really work it to get any business done. And when I went to JP Morgan, you know, what I noticed was it's an amazing firm. And it was then an amazing firm with a tremendous, you know, with tremendously more resources than I had at my disposal, that a lot of the people weren't optimizing, you know, they weren't making max use of it. Where for me, you know, I was like a kid in a candy store. You know, now instead of calling up a client and say, you know, I work at Bank of Montreal, I was saying I'm from JP Morgan. And, you know, it's you know, and I think people saw that I didn't, you know, kind of wait for things to happen. You know, I kind of was somebody that was trying to make things happen. So, I mean, hopefully that's, you know, somewhat helpful to your listeners.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's really good advice. On the flip side, kind of to my other question, are there any specific things like traits or just indicators that you look for in potential mentees?
Well, you know, I had some other mentors, but to answer that one about the mentees, it was funny when I did a year or so at Jefferies between More Capital and what I'm doing now. It wasn't the right fit for me, and I really didn't love the firm. You know, I'd worked in much bigger shops, and you know, at that point in my career, Jefferies was a little bit of a bucket shop in what I in the area that I was in. It's a good firm, but for what I was doing, it wasn't, you know, near the capability that I was used to. And, you know, I think I had three summer interns. One was from Amherst, one was from Columbia, and one was from the University of Florida. And what I found was kind of a similar thing to what I just mentioned, which is the kid from the University of Florida, he was just much more on the ball. You know, he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He knew how hard he had to work. Mm-hmm. He dug deeper. He wasn't just looking to kind of get through his work. He was really looking to try to understand what was the thrust of the assignment and things of that nature. So when I'm looking at mentees, I'm really looking for people that, you know, they don't mind doing the dirty work. You know, they're looking to get to the root of a problem. You know, they look for help and ask good questions. And they're not just trying to, you know, buy their time. They're really trying to, you know, kind of make connections and network. So I think those are the best mentees.
Okay.
And he got hired and the other two didn't.
Fair enough. So I mentioned earlier that part of the reason I started this whole thing was because, like, financial literacy and just economics in general, it's not really something that we learn as part of our core curriculum or just in high school in general in most cases. So first of all, like, why do you think that is? Why do you think, A, it's not something that's focused on, and B, just in general, why aren't younger people more financially literate, like, as a priority?
That's a really good question. My kids, their high school had it. They had a class in personal finance. You know, it depends upon where you go to school. I mean, they went to private school. So, you know, it could well have been that somebody recommended it and somebody said, hey, this is a good elective to have. It certainly wasn't a requirement. So that, you know, that kind of speaks to your point. I think, you know, other places it just might be, you know, kind of the slow moving bureaucracy with a lot of budgetary issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, you know, maybe it's just hard to make the case. And it could well be that, you know, kind of compare it foundationally to, you know, to other things like, you know, history or math. Or science, it's, you know, maybe it kind of falls down. But, you know, I would think that, you know, kind of economics, you know, the basics of economics and, you know, kind of the history of economic thought, I think those would be useful. And in fact, you know, I kind of a few years back, I had thought about maybe going up to a prep school and teaching a class like that. And I know that one school had it, not all schools had it. Berkshire Academy up in Massachusetts had it. But you know, not all of them do. You know, they like to think of themselves as, you know, a little bit client driven or student driven. And, you know, there just might not have been as much interest.
Okay.
I mean, kids are trying to get into college, right? And, you know, they have to think, okay, if I'm going to take, you know, 4 or 5 APs. I want to be on that track. But I do think it's like when I was going to high school, you know, we had, you know, like wood shop and metal shop and, you know, home economics and things of that nature. So, you know, I think it is definitely one of those things that should be offered. Not that I think people, you know, at young ages, you know, aren't exposed to, you know, personal finance, but I do think they can kind of get, you know, maybe they can kind of misconstrue what it's really all about, and, you know, just kind of how to manage, you know, credit cards and budgets and things of that nature. I mean, it's obviously not complicated.
So this is also partly a crypto podcast, right? So you can't,
go ahead.
Can't really do that without talking about what's been happening recently with Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX and kind of all the fraud that's going on. So from your perspective, do you think this is going to be like a big problem for digital markets going forward? How do you think it's going to affect that?
Well, you know, I kind of come at it, you know, a little bit late in the game. I mean, my son had mentioned something to me about it because he did some computer science when he was at university. And so he kind of, hey, you should look at this stuff. It's pretty interesting. And, you know, I think he might've bought some Ethereum at like $200. And then probably sold it at like 300. But, You know, I think he kind of had a, you know, a general sense of things, and, you know, it looked pretty interesting. You know, I mean, I kind of read the white paper. You know, I kind of knew some of the players involved. You know, I know Dan Moorhead personally. I know Dan Tapiero. I know some of the people that have kind of been in the center of the whole thing. You know, and they're legitimate people that, you know, kind of know up from down. And, you know, I think there's, you know, there's probably something there. But it seemed to kind of develop this almost mania that it becomes a little bit hard to understand and appreciate exactly what the kind of the foundational points are and the use cases are.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I kind of like to look at it kind of almost at a 20,000 foot level. And I think, you know, everything kind of got, it was kind of like ping ponging between like, you know, how do I make money? You know, you got to get in, you know, have fun staying poor, you know, thanks boomer, you know, there's a lot of really interesting technology here that, you know, could solve some problems like, you know, cross-border payments, you know, helping oppressed people in inflationary or oppressive regimes kind of either, you know, as a decent store of value and be able to kind of, you know, retain their, you know, stored productivity. So, I mean, you kind of look at it, you're like, okay, I think there's kind of something there, but, you know, what, you know, like I'm a, okay, so, you know, tell me what this is and how to value it, you know, how to value, you know, something like Bitcoin or Ether. And, you know, none of those things really kind of resonated with me. You know, I think you can price them in the same way that you can price, you know, art or, you know, a collectible. You know, I think there's a price that, you know, people will want, but in terms of trying to value it, and then I don't think you can do that. They don't throw off cash flows. And then all this stuff that's kind of added on top of it to kind of create this ecosystem, or, you know, you know, what they call DeFi, but there's a lot of centralization within it.
Right.
And then, you know, then you obviously you start seeing some of these things that, you know, kind of built on top of it that, you know, have some combination of, you know, mismanagement and poor risk control and obviously fraud. And, you know, you're just kind of looking at it going like, wow, this is a mess.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely looks that way at the moment. So one of the things that went awfully wrong with FTX, right, was just the total lack of management and organization there. Obviously, no one really did enough due diligence into FTX before kind of investing in it. So what's your process for identifying good management teams before you invest?
Well, you know, I think the most interesting thing that I've seen wasn't that, you know, there were a lot of evangelists that were kind of talking up the entire space.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen different bubbles and I've studied a lot of them. And I would encourage anybody that kind of is looking to kind of get involved in finance to really study as much as possible economic history. And you know, I think bubbles are kind of a really interesting, you know, intersection of kind of economics and psychology, and the, you know, I guess the madness of crowds. But I think we kind of have these situations from time to time where, you know, there's just so much happening so quickly that people just suspend their common sense. And I think the most interesting thing for me was to see the venture capitalists that are highly respected, like Sequoia, you know, Temasek from Singapore. I mean, they're really well run. And so, you know, it became a little bit odd that, you know, outside money was coming in thinking, you know, well, I don't really want to buy the coins. I'll invest in some of these platforms and exchanges. And then they didn't have board seats.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of found that to be, you know, kind of somewhat odd. And truth be told, I'm an investor in, you know, one of those players. And luckily, they kind of invest status shot into like a lots of names. So their you know, involvement with FTX is de minimis. And since it's like, you know, money that I'm not counting on for like another 10 years, I'm sure they'll recover from it. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you're looking at businesses, you're looking at and the people that are running them. You know, when you're looking at public company businesses, you're looking for the people that are just, you know, they know what their company is all about. You know, they're running and they're executing really well and they're allocating capital really efficiently. So, you know, if you look at like kind of what's been going on with Disney, you know, Iger is a really, he's not only a good manager of a bit of an existing business, he's really careful about how he allocates capital.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Chet Beck, you know, is an interesting guy. I actually heard him speak at my daughter's graduation from college. You know, I think, you know, he made some bad calls, and, you know, but public companies like that, you know, there's so many eyes on it. When I'm investing in a private venture, and I've done a few of those that have worked out quite nicely, it really just comes down to, you know, the quality of the people, how hard they're, you know, working, what are they giving up? You know, how they kind of carry themselves, whether or not, you know, they deliver what they say they're going to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the interesting thing about Sam Bankman-Fried is that, you know, he kind of went from 0 to 100 miles an hour in a heartbeat.
Right.
And, you know, I think there's a little bit of, you know, that with guys like Elon Musk as well. You know, I was just reading an article today about the Boring Company, how just it, like there are, you know, cities and municipalities that were like, wow, this is going to be a really good solution to our problem. Instead of building like light rail, they're going to go underneath the surface. I mean, it's just all garbage, you know, the Cybertruck or, you know, this product or that product. And, you know, and yet, you know, he personally is worth a couple hundred billion and, you know, has, you know, Tesla's a legitimate company with, you know, with purpose. SpaceX does some really good things. You know, what he's done with Twitter is probably going to end up being, you know, quite an albatross for him. You know, whether or not it's, you know, is the equivalent of his Waterloo, I don't know. But I do think that, you know, and I'm just not big into the hype machine. And so, you know, I think when I look at companies and I look at people, I particularly these businesses that rely on kind of virality,
mm-hmm.
I want to know that the, you know, the person there understands that, you know, virality is good. It's a very big positive when you actually achieve, because things can really metastasize quite quickly. That doesn't mean that you should ever be disingenuous and that you shouldn't, you know, you should kind of play the system.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of that these days, you know, people trying to, you know, they're like spinning stuff nonstop. That just drives me insane. You know, you don't need to just, you know, just execute.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you seem not super critical, but like somewhat critical of the viral aspect of crypto. And I guess question, it's like long-term standing. So I kind of have a question. Do you view this whole FTX thing as, it's probably some of both, but as a failure of crypto or as a failure of their own mismanagement?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously they, you know, they've mismatched something. I mean, what's right. Interesting is I don't understand where the capital hole came from, where the money went. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to answer that question. You know, I suspect that it's probably been some speculation gone awry. So, and then, you know, then using customer money, to try to buy time to fill that capital hole. If you read a book called Rogue Traders by Scott Skirm, you kind of can see a bunch of different situations where, people, they lost a lot of money, and, they almost always try to cover it up somehow. And they're always trying to make it back, whether it's Nick Leeson or, from Barings. It's just, there's a long history of those types of players. And so it's hard to say, whether or not he was running a legit business in an effective way. I suspect that it's probably, look, there were real customers that were trading on his exchange.
Yeah.
Had their money there. He had a separate business that was market making. They shouldn't, obviously they shouldn't be intertwined. They're not intertwined in a regulated, in any regulated industry like what we're used to in, in kind of in finance. Since I don't know the specifics of how that all kind of played itself out, it probably looks more like, just general, kind of mismanagement and fraud. Maybe it wasn't bad intentions. Maybe he had all intention to make back whatever the losses were and, and then, kind of return the, I don't know. It's not for me to say. What is for me to say is that the entire ecosystem made things like that possible because people weren't asking the right questions and weren't, like literally auditing these things with a fine tooth comb. But regulators and politicians, here to China, have been saying, hey, this is kind of a sketchy space. There's a lot of interesting things that are going on in it. But there's, some interesting, segments of the technology, but, the way that it's kind of developed, it looks pretty darn sketchy, and you can, you're risking losing all your money. I think, I don't think enough people really paid heed to that, although they're certainly learning that lesson now.
So about risk, what's your philosophy on when it's smarter to kind of turn up the risk or turn it down? And just to follow up, where do you think we are now on that cycle?
I think risk, it's always related to whether or not you kind of feel like the odds are in your favor. And, if you're at a craps table or, playing blackjack or poker, you have this kind of mental picture of, I think I've kind of got it all lined out. And, if I had this situation 100 times, there's a very high, positive expected value to doing, these things. So that's kind of how I like to think of it. Like when, things are kind of lined up a particular way, and there's different ways of, kind of calculating what those things are in the investing space. Probably not the time to go through that, but, just kind of looking at the, the fact pattern that you have and go, I think this is a useful bet. But, and to be bigger and outsized relative to others, but they never should exceed, a number that, maybe, 5 to 10% of your capital. Mm-hmm. And it'll depend also on kind of how the year's going and, any number of other things. But, I always kind of like to think of it as, anywhere between, 2 to 5% is kind of a normal bet, 5 to 10% or so, I'm feeling pretty good. More than that, I think it's a pretty short thing. But, I try not to hang around too long. If I'm wrong, okay, I'm wrong and I'm gone. And it's easy to say that in public markets because liquidity is pretty decent. in private markets or in real estate or in, other markets with, high transaction costs and illiquid, or you kind of even can't get out. It's, you have to be even more careful about what percentage of your assets are kind of sitting in those, those things. So like, what's interesting is to see, like, how Sam Bankman-Fried was investing, whether it was his money or clients' money, in some of the firms that were investing in him, but, private equity generally, those are illiquid assets. You don't get those back because you need it. I mean, there's really not a secondary market for it. There's a little bit of one that's kind of developing, but you're usually going to get like 50 cents on the dollar at best. So, I think the critical thing is just, understanding the game you're playing, understand what you're playing for, understand what your style is, understand what your process is, what your edge is. And when things aren't going the way you want, or a trade is not going the way you want, just get out.
Yeah.
Just don't let it distract you. Because then you become, then you're a zealot. Yeah. And, how many different things can, there's just so many things out there that you can wager on.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, because I think it's really easy to get caught up, especially when a lot of other people, like in crypto, are getting, very into it and caught up with, I guess, like the viral hype, as you said before.
Well, you can't even, like, if you put something in Twitter that is, just like a marginal statement about the crypto universe, you get all these people that are coming flying at you. It's like, what's going on? Right, I don't know if they're exactly people or they're bots, but it just kind of tells you that, that's not, these aren't rational thoughts.
Right.
This isn't open-minded stuff. This is people that are trying to kind of create a wave. And, and I appreciate it, but, you have to be able to kind of, like, emotional management is one of the most important things to learn to invest. It's why, one of the things that I would advise any younger person to do is, you're going to go to college, you're going to get a job, you're going to start making money, you'll be like 26 or 27, you'll probably have some extra money. And I would say, okay, it might not be a lot, but give the money to somebody else. Because your main job is to maximize yourself in your day job, not in investing side. So just because investing now is easier and reasonably inexpensive, doesn't mean anybody is personally that good at it. And most importantly, excess trading is the fastest way to lose money. And there's like a relationship between the more trades you do, is kind of negatively related to kind of, how much wealth you ultimately attain. So the best thing to do is just, save like there's no tomorrow, take as much risk within your savings world in terms of, emerging markets or, different types of products, but, do them in good proportions, but just leave it. Don't pay attention to it. Don't look at it and go, I'm poor, you'll be fine as long as you, kind of optimize your career. And by the end of it, you'll look and go, okay, this is pretty good nest egg.
Yeah, I think that's really important advice. So anyone listening to this, definitely take note of that. So just, I think we have a few minutes left. So I just wanted to get your opinion on some kind of like this, just some general advice for teenagers, younger people in general. So what skills do you think younger people should be focusing on developing if they're preparing for a career in finance?
Skills. Look, math, reasoning, there's so many different parts of finance. I just think is, try to talk to people that do it. I don't think there's any particular skills, I just think just kind of, you know, learning as much as you can about kind of how it all works. And most importantly, you know, kind of, you know, get a much kind of broader perspective of kind of how it really fits into the universe. Like what finance is all about. Like sometimes, you know, like even for me, I got into it because it was a way to make money. But the reality is like, you know, you'll make money. You go like, what the hell am I doing? You know, what purpose am I serving? And I think that, you know, the people that'll end up doing the best understand what finance is all about and what markets are all about. And they're really about, you know, kind of helping businesses and people meet goals. And I think if you can kind of, you know, center around that, you'll be in really good shape. Like these things are not, they're just not ways, you know, to kind of make a quick buck.
Yeah.
You know, they're, you know, and maybe I learned this when I was at JP Morgan, when I first came out of business school. You know, our job was to, you know, help our clients grow, help them solve problems. And, you know, whether that was giving them financing or it was solving a risk management problem or solving an operational problem or, you know, getting access to information that could help, you know, they could kind of think about where they might want to grow their business or where they might want to kind of protect some of their assets. It was always about, you know, trying to help an end user. And I think, you know, the people that will, you know, like what's the skill set? I think the skill set is, you know, kind of, you know, well-roundedness, you know, a broad okay. understanding of where this all fits.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. For sure. Thank you so much. So lastly, for our audience, if anyone watching wants to kind of find more, just find anything more about like your ideas or any content that you have, is there anywhere they can do that?
Well, I occasionally write, I haven't written for a while, for a friend's newsletter called Hedge Fund Telemetry. It's a paid service, so I'm not sure they'll have access to everything, but my stuff's usually free.
Okay.
And I'll kind of write about some, you know, broad macro themes that I've been kind of noodling over and studying. And I occasionally post on Twitter at Dave Newman 64.
All right. Yeah. Sounds awesome. So I urge anyone to for sure check that out. And Dave, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Alan.
Really enjoyed having you.
Appreciate it.